Welcome to the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Support for the Archive Project comes from Cole Haan, the fashion brand that's acknowledging extraordinary people who write, read, and shape the world through their extraordinary stories. All this and more at colehaan.com. I just want to start off today with a corny joke. A writer and a brain surgeon are chatting at a cocktail party. The brain surgeon says, "It's so great you're a writer. When I retire, I'm going to become one too." The writer responds warily, "Oh, that's funny, because when I retire, I'm going to become a brain surgeon." Like I said, it's a corny joke, but as someone who loves books, I am always a little suspicious when a Hollywood star or a famous political figure publishes fiction. A memoir, sure, but short stories, the hardest of all forms of fiction? So it's remarkable that Uncommon Type is a book of accomplished stories. The great novelist Ann Patchett described it this way, quote, "Reading Tom Hanks's Uncommon Type is like finding out that Alice Munro is also the greatest actress of our time." This onstage conversation gives insight on the perspective and the process of an incredibly gifted creative person. Hanks borrows the lessons of empathy and the insights into human motivation from decades of performing and applies them with humor, sensitivity, and artistry to fiction. Here's Hanks.
Thank you.
Hi. So I'm so honored to be here with you, Tom, and thank you so much for all coming out. I wanted to start at the beginning of this book, which I read with intense admiration and wonder. So this book is dedicated to your family, but it's also dedicated to Nora. Nora Ephron, your director, your collaborator. And you've said in interviews that she was the first person who said you were a writer. Mm-hmm. What did she say?
I was an extremely cranky actor at the time I met her for the first time. And we were talking about the Sleepless in Seattle. And I had seen the movie that she had directed, and I was certainly aware of all of her chops that were spread across all of the arts, all of her fabulous career, and was impressed with her that she had made a film as authentic as, I'm going to scream out the name of the first film in a second, and if anybody can out there scream it for me, I'd appreciate it. Pardon me? Now you'll get it later on. It had Julie Kavner in it, and she was playing a single mom who was becoming a stand-up comedian. And when we were putting it all together, I had she and her sister Delia, who were writing it. I was not only a cranky actor, but I was also a guy who kept saying to them, "You guys, you wrote a man, you wrote a dad, and you don't get it. You don't know what it's like to be a man and to be a dad." You know, they had the big scene was where I was going to go out on a date, and the kid didn't want me to go out on a date, and they wrote a scene in which the dad said, "Well, I just don't know what to do. My son doesn't want me. He doesn't want me to go out." And I said, "Are you nuts? You know what a dad would say to a kid who said, 'I don't want you to go out with her'? Shut up, kid. You listen to me, you little brat, you little monster. I'm the man of this house, and guess what? I want to get L-A-I-D. And some version of that ended up in the movie. And when we were all done, Nora said, "You know, you wrote that scene." I said, "I didn't write that scene. I was just cranky during one of our meetings. And I was ragging on you." And she said, "No, that's what writing is, to come up with something." And we collaborated on two other big things. We made You've Got Mail, and then she was around. She passed away just before we went into rehearsals for her play, Lucky Guy. And she and I exchanged an awful lot of stuff that she was working on that I didn't do. And also I began to send her some things, screenplays, of course, and ideas for movies. But the major thing that happened was my makeup man, Danny Strepek, who I had made 15 movies with, called me not long after we wrapped. I'm not trying to drop all the names of these movies, but that's actually how I keep track of time, you know? I don't know how old I was, but I do know that I made The Da Vinci Code for about 6 months. And after The Da Vinci Code, Dan called me up and said, "Kid, you're the first call I'm making. I am done. And I don't mean done, I mean done, done. He was retiring. And I congratulated him. I said, and I wanted to ask him about his career, which I spent about 4 hours with him, and I wrote a piece about him, about my relationship with him and his really impressive history. Danny, he manufactured the masks for the first Planet of the Apes. He made Laurence Olivier's nose for Spartacus, and he applied Elvis Presley's tan in Viva Las Vegas. So he had kind of an amazing career. And I wrote this thing, and I sent it to Nora, and I said, Nora, is this a thing? And she says, yes, it is. Not quite, but it will be. And when you finish, you'll send it to the New York Times, and they won't run it in the Sunday-style section, but they will run it in the Thursday-style section. And that's exactly what happened. But in the exchange back and forth, Nora just kind of like tore me a new one when it came down to attempting a piece of journalism that was usually like twice the length of a normal piece would be, because it was a bit of a feature. And she said, after many, many, many suggestions and drafts, she sent me what back, the last time I sent her a piece, well, what do you think of this? She just wrote back, voice, 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 voice. Meaning that you got something there, but where's your voice? And the book says, the title page or the dedication is because of Nora. Because Nora said to me, your instinctive thrust, as far as your day job goes, is just an application of discipline and will to becoming a writer. And if you want to do that, you've got the goods, but you're going to have to do the work. You don't have to develop your voice.
I mean, when I teach, voice is the thing that the conversation returns to, that students are obsessed with. How do I sound distinctive? How do I sound like myself? And I think there are probably writers here who are also wondering about this question. And this book has such an idiosyncratic, particular grain in the voice. And I was wondering, how did you go about developing voice, voice, voice?
Well, I think it comes back to what my day job is, which I don't really ever, I haven't thought about what I do for my popular living. Ever since I was in high school, I just, you know, kind of like saw it, had an instinctive thrust and threw myself into it. And if anybody wanted to tell me to knock it off and try something else, I was more than happy to. Every one of the stories I'm trying to think of how best to put it. I don't want to say voice, but it does. It has a patina. It has a tempo to it. It has a perspective that comes down into, well, is it written in the first person? Or is it much more narrative? I've been very lucky that I've done enough films with enough filmmakers to get a sense of their style, their voice, each one very different from the other, even right down to how they shoot or rehearse a film. And so I was lucky that I was pliable enough to just go along with somebody else establishing what the rules are. And I found that the idea for a story needed a theme that was worthy of being examined, but it also needed that narrative sensibility. It had to have rules. And once I was able to discover the rules, then I could follow them. And I must say also, you know, this began because I had a short story that was printed in the New Yorker, which struck me as they were in between leadership roles over there or something. I fell into some kind of crack, you know. It's like, who'd you send, Esther Newberg, my agent, who'd you send this to? Well, we tried People Magazine, and then we tried Star Magazine and OK out of the UK, but then we sent it to the New Yorker, and they seemed to bite at it. It was like, well, that's just astounding to me. And then when the call came in, would you like to do some more? I said, well, I've got more themes that I'd like to examine, but how many would it be? And they said, well, we need about 15. And I went, 15, you know, I think I can muster that up. I think I can come up with that, some filler. But as they came to me and as they got written and as I did the work, there was, quite frankly, a bit of a yearning in order to land on some other set of rules for some of the stories. There's columns from a cranky newspaper columnist. There's a bit of a screenplay version of a story that comes in, and I go back and forth between the narrative styles and some of the perspectives.
Yeah, and I think that's what's going to strike people as they read this book is just, it's what struck me is how playful it is and how inventive it is on the level of form. You know, you're trying to do so many different things and you tell stories in so many different ways. Were these pent up stories?
Some of them definitely were. I have a company of, you know, a production company. You know, every knothead actor has a production company for a while. But mine's lasted for a really good long time because I allied myself about 20 years ago with people who know how to do the things that I don't know how to do. And I did that so that I would not be an actor waiting for the phone to ring to say, would you please come on and do something? I wanted to create some version of our own product. And all we do down at the office is lean in each other's doorways and say, you know that thing you read? Is that a movie or is it more like a TV series? I don't know if we can cover that in... I think we need 10 or 12 hours to do that. And will anybody buy that? So we're always looking for what the form is going to be, the best way to examine what the theme really is that deserves examination. And sometimes it's a documentary. And some, you know, we'll play around with almost anything. But a number of them, well, like, for example, there's one, it's called A Welcome to Mars. It's about a father who takes his son surfing on his birthday on an anonymous day in the summertime. And that came about because I am possibly the most horrible, embarrassing surfer you ever saw. I mean, I am, just imagine what I would look like and pretty much got it, you know. It's kind of like goofy, you know, all my posture's never right. But I was surfing about, I'm going to say almost 30 years ago. And I was coming up out of the water, and it was early morning. It was a work day, and I saw in a very expensive automobile a guy in his surfer wetsuit, and he had a towel around himself, and he was talking to a very, very beautiful woman who was behind the driver's seat of this expensive car. And I just thought,
that's a story.
What's going on there? Yeah, what's happening between those two? Is that illicit or? And. Then, so that always stuck in my head, and I always thought that there was some aspect of a son discovering that his father was not quite the man he was supposed to be, and how deep would those ripples be?
What's so? I mean, my hunch is that for every writer, a story presents itself in a different way. You know, I'm sure there's some writers that are motivated by a memory or a character. What's the germ of a story for you? What do you need to get started?
Honestly, sometimes I need a title, you know, a title.
Do you really start with a title?
Give
me an example from
this
book.
I will tell you. I was sitting around talking to a fellow, a friend of mine, and, you know, just kind of like bullshit thing that, you know, somebody in the famous people's club, you know, hey, I know you, you know me, we're famous, let's talk. You know, it happens, you know. we started talking about... memorabilia, you know, and shows for memorabilia, because we sometimes every now we land on what's the show on PBS? I'm talking to an Oregon audience, in which they bring their Antiques Roadshow, you know, and how there's some things that are pieces of junk and some things are valuable, and we were both fascinated by this, and he said to me, I love that show because it demonstrates how important the past can be to us. And there's a story in there that's about time travel. We ended up talking about what we would do if we had a time machine and where we would go. So you got one day. You can go to any place you want to. Where would you go? And mine has always been the 1939 World's Fair. And so I wrote a story called Because the Past is Important to It. It literally came from that title. Others, you get a sense of what the... I work towards the last line or the last paragraph or sometimes just the last image... of one, and there's a story called A Special Weekend about a boy who is taken up in an airplane for the first time by his mom's new boyfriend, and he looks for them up in the sky, and there's no sign of them anywhere up in the sky as they flew away. So I had written three or four of them. Actually, I wrote one The second story I wrote was Go See Costa, which is the story of my father-in-law, actually. And we put a typewriter in it. And Peter Gethers, my agent, said, oh, I like that little bit with a typewriter. And I said, you know, I always asked him permission, you know, can I write a story 12 pages long? Yes, you can. You can write a story 12 pages long. Can I write a story for? Yes, you can. Can I do it in blue ink? If you want to do it in blue ink, you go right ahead. Are there rules? I don't want to piss anybody off. I just, you know, I want to get a B+ for this and then, you know, get out of Dodge. I said, what if I put a typewriter in every story, like an Easter egg? And maybe it's a big thing and maybe it's just a small thing. And he granted his permission for me to do that. And a couple of the stories just began with a typewriter. Where would that typewriter be and what would be the history around it?
So they say that people who speak multiple languages are a little bit different in every language they speak. And I was wondering if something is true for artists who rove across different disciplines. You know, you've been on the stage, you've been on film, now you're in fiction. And I wonder, are you attracted to different stories, or do you see a certain kind of continuity in the stories and questions and characters that you're attracted to?
I get this a lot in my day job, which is as a two-time Academy Award winning I'm sorry. Shame on me. Sometimes you just gotta uncork that.
You just have to let the people know sometimes.
Well, you know, we call it dropping the H-bomb every now and again, you know. Excuse me, yeah, 3 for dinner? We do not have any tables available, I'm sorry. I'm Tom Hanks. Let me see what I can do. It's shameless, I'm sorry. It's absolutely shameless, but... Yeah, it's one of the reasons people go into the business. There is a countenance that I think that any artist carries. And it doesn't necessarily matter what the discipline is that they're working in, that countenance remains. And that is some combination of who they are secretly, who they are externally by way of the entire body of work and what it has meant to people that has seen it by and large. And sometimes it can be viewed as the negative aspects of pigeonholing, right? Like you'll never be anything other than a light comedian, or you'll never be anything other than a dark heavy. Once Vincent Price played his first bad guy, he was always Vincent Price, the bad guy from there on in. Well, you can look at that in a negative form. Or you can look at it as quite liberating, because then every time you take a job, every time you're drawn to something to say yes to, you get to secretly expand the level of what that countenance is. So you're no longer just a color on the rainbow, but you can kind of get into the red and the orange and the green and off to the dark side, indigo, violet. Red, blue, orange, yellow, indigo. Roy G. Biv, which is the way you remembered it back in science school. What are the colors of the rainbow? Just think of your good friend Roy G. Biv. So in that, I must say, I was never, the only thing that intimidated me about this was the actual workload, the actual process, the solitary job of writing something that you and only you can determine is should go on. But the nature of the, if I can be so bold, as the countenance of all the stories always did come back to, I think, this, which also governs the vast majority of choices I make in my day job. And that is, I'm not interested in the standard antagonist-protagonist narrative. I enjoy movies where someone says, before I kill you, Mr. Bond, perhaps you'd like a tour of my installation. Those things are fun and they're a blast. Or, you know, Ultra Cam comes down from his planet and he wants to enslave the Earth and turn us all into food. I dig that. Those are fun sometimes. But in order for it to be truly the reason I think we all search out art or stories or film, television, is to see some version of ourselves. And versions of ourselves are always just trying to get to the end of the day. If we're lucky, we meet somebody who's like-minded and aids us. The second best luck you can have is that you meet an obstacle that slows you down just for a while, but then you get around it. And I think that translates from what I do for what I've done for a living since I was 21 to what I started up when I was 61.
Or even I think it's there even before that. I read a wonderful interview that you did when you were talking about growing up and realizing the essential difference between you and your father.
My father was a chef, and then he taught in a vocational school, hotel and restaurant food preparation.
Right, and I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you had some version of the quote where you said that my father was very good with his hands.
Yes, he was.
And I was very good with my verbs.
Yeah.
And it's an extraordinary thing to say. And so I wanted to talk about when did that early sensitivity and pleasure in language, when did that begin for you?
Very early, because I was the third of four kids, but I never lived with my younger brother. My parents split up when he was just a baby. So I was always the youngest in the house, and everybody else pioneered the boundaries of behavior. You know, the older kids got in trouble for doing things, and my older brother kind of like showed how you could navigate, you know, between all the stuff because the prow of the ship was getting beaten up by the ice. And I was just the guy in the back who could add the wisecrack to it, you know, and somehow be viewed as adorable. And doesn't that just explain my career in a nutshell? But I grew up never intimidated by a new circumstance. We moved around a lot, and I was always going into some new school, and I always thought it was of a grand adventure. My other members of my family were more crippled by a type of shyness that my dad had, but I always just thought, hot damn, man, I'm going to a brand new fifth grade today. Who needs seducing? I'm here to seduce you. I never ran afoul of any teacher. Never. Even though I was a guy in the back cracking wise. Every now and again they say, all right, Mr. Hanks. You're so great. You're so funny. I'm gonna give you an A, but knock that off.
But why is that? Is it because you had some sort of preternatural ability to understand how people work and to sort of figured that out?
I would have to say, look, well, doctor, we only have 50 minutes in order to get to the bottom
of
this. Okay, all right. I think that I grew up in a, even though my parents divorced a lot and we moved around a lot, everybody I came across was pretty benevolent and fair. I think that's a big deal. I never thought I was getting the raw end of a deal, except by, you know, I think there may be like the proportion I think is the same. I think 90% of the people in the world are good and fair and live by some version of what the golden rule is. You know, treat other people as you would like to be treated yourself. I think 5% are absolute but that's a pretty good proportion. If you get away with only 5%, you're ahead of the game. And I'm going to say somewhere, you know, the remainder is just some people are just stark raving nuts, and there's nothing you could do to help them. I mean, you know, I'm sorry, but 90% of good people—that's who I felt as though that an awful lot of things came into account that allowed me that kind of access. But that's the way I always felt, and I felt that from a very early age.
I want to ask you a quick question about your Instagram.
Okay.
Which I really recommend. I'm not even on Instagram, but I will get on my husband's account just to lurk on your account because it's so good. It's so good.
That's kind of like, diabolical, isn't
it? That's, you know, it's my harmless vice. Typewriters to you.
Yeah, I get it. Internet I get it. Everybody's got a hand. That's a harmless vice.
It's so your Instagram, if I were to describe it, and there's a lot going on there, but by and large, it's it's almost as if your camera is trained on the ground and you take pictures of lost and forgotten objects. So a glove, discarded umbrella, a child's shoe, and there's some little puns like lost soul. And I love this. I love it. It's funny, but it also sort of strikes me, I find it very moving. And it strikes me, it's almost like you have this surplus of empathy that's sort of spilling over onto these objects. And I was wondering, is empathy important to you as a writer? Is it something you think about in your fiction, trying to evoke it in your reader too?
If I was going to try to define what empathy is, it might be the question that I think art creates, is what would I do if I was in the same situation? How would I handle that? And sometimes it can be fantastic. You'd be something from a mythical era, but you'll still kind of think, what would I do under that circumstance? And I don't know if I'm sure some of the greatest art in the world has been created with absolutely no empathy whatsoever, you know? Somebody writes and says, this is the way it is, deal with it. And if you have a disagreement, you're wrong! That's okay, because you can choose to disagree with it, and then you move on down the line. I didn't really know that I wanted to be an actor, but I knew that I wanted to be part of something that was as fervid, is that a word? Fervent, turgid, exciting, involving, focused as being an ensemble player in the telling of a story. The first professional play that I was ever in, I just played a servant in Hamlet. But we got to hear the Hamlet deliver his advice to the players every night. And when he says, hold the mirror up to nature, I thought that was like, that's what we do. Because you can ask yourself, what would I do if I was an old man and I was Polonius? Or what would I do if I was a young woman in love with Hamlet like Ophelia is? And you can also ask yourself, what would I do if I was Hamlet? I'd probably be pretty pissed off. And I think that can be skewed as maybe not actual empathy, but can guide you into that sense of fairness that I think that we always seek.
You did choose for this book what's been called one of the most unforgiving art forms. Like novels, you can get away with a lot. They're big and baggy, but in the short story, it feels like everything has to be purposeful.
Yeah.
Everything has to matter and have some significance and some relationship to the story. Can you tell me a little bit about some of the pleasures of working with this art form?
I would say that the biggest one is where I started writing about one thing and ended up writing about something else. There's a saying among some of the directors I know is that when they start cutting the movie, which is the third time you make the movie from scratch, they say the movie will tell us what it needs to be. And you have to be open to that kind of like title shift. And for example, there's a story called Christmas Eve 1953, which started out for me. I just wanted to talk about guys who were 20 years old in the Battle of the Bulge that maybe survived it, and what they were like when they were 29 or 30 or 31. How can they go from that at the absolute apex of their youth? Then 10 years later, be setting up an electric train around the Christmas tree for their 10-year-old kids. How do they do that? What did they talk it out? What was the mental and physical journey that they went through from that absolute hell in one place where their lives were on hold for the better part of 5 years to act two when they're just beginning to get on with the rest of things? And in writing it, I was concentrating on Virgil, who is the veteran coming home on Christmas Eve, 1953. But then it shifted to his old buddy that calls him every Christmas Eve at the same time. And their experiences have taken them to completely different places in the cultural zeitgeist of a combat veteran. One man is embraced in the great warm hearth of family. He got literally some version of a reward for what he went through. And the other guy will never get that, and he'll never even be close to that. When you write, just give me a show of applause. Who here writes, you know? Just, all right. So, you know as well as I do that every now and again you type something, and it's so good you got to sit back and go, you look around for somebody to share it with, and guess what? You're in a room all by yourself for another 5.5 hours. But there was a guy, Virgil says to his buddy on the phone, Bud, he says, come on, you know, I things are busy at the shop. Why don't you, if you ever need anything, come on by and I'll put you to, you can work for me in the shop. And he said, oh man, I'd rather punch a cop than punch a clock. And I might have heard that before, but when I wrote it, I just thought I was smoking hot there. You know, I just thought, oh, Tommy, you're in the high country now. That is, but I wouldn't know how to do it any other way other than starting with what you think is 5 or 6 really great beats in a theme that is fascinating to you, but then you discover this whole other tributary that you end up going down, and it ends up being what, you know, what those 44 or 27 or 60 pages need in order to make it have that solid beginning, middle, and end that every story really has, but also be that theme, make it worthy of the theme that you are trying to examine.
No, and I think that that's actually, it sounds like your process is actually, in certain ways, it reminds me of what your stories are about, which is like the role of chance and choice in life.
Serendipity, exactly,
yeah. And, and sort of like how do people's lives happen to them? And, you know, I've read all the reviews and of your book, and one of the things that I wonder why people aren't mentioning more is how many of these stories are about immigrants and immigrant life.
Yeah.
So I was wondering about your, where does your sort of curiosity, or what is the potential of that character for you?
I grew up in Oakland, California, which I didn't realize at the time, but might have been officially the most integrated city in America, you know. I rode the bus with, and it was every nationality and heritage and, you know, that there was. My stepmother, who was the great love of my dad's life, was a woman named Frances Wong. And she grew up, she was a first-generation American. Her parents were from China. And she grew up in San Francisco Chinatown when it truly was a cultural ghetto, when, you know, literally no Caucasians lived in there. And they called Grant Street the Dobangai, and she spoke with an accent. I grew up in a lot of naval housing, you know, guys in the Navy. And there were always Latinos and Filipinos there. I just grew up around a large melange, if I'm using the words correctly, a hodgepodge of people whose parents all came from all over the place. I made a movie with a bunch of guys from Somalia. Three of them had the most stunning stories of how they came to America, and here's what they all had in common. They loved living in Minneapolis, Minnesota. I want to say, hey, you like, oh, I love Minnesota. Isn't it cold? Yes, it's very cold, but I love Minnesota. There's one of the stories that in it's literally, it's the immigrants, it's the saga of my father-in-law, how he came to America right after World War II. And so I think there are people that are just looking for a fair shake and a fair opportunity. And I think that's, you know, that is one of the promises of the promised land that America is supposed to be. You come and you do the work, and oh, I would say that the Somali guys is the root of one of the characters in the four characters. His name is M-Dash, and he's one of the guys that comes in. He said, I just love America. I don't know how it works, but I love America.
Okay, which character gave you the most trouble?
Trouble is one thing. The one that was the hardest, I would say, to write from a purely emotional perspective is the little boy in a story called A Special Weekend. His name is Kenny, and it's autobiographical enough in spirit, not necessarily in detail, that I sent it to my siblings, and I said, "Hey, look, this isn't us, but it's kind of like what we. It's not us, but it's kind of like us." And they all wrote back and said, "Yeah, that sounds about right. Yeah, that was pretty much what it was like." And I wanted to write a story about a little boy's impressions of how special it was to spend a weekend with his mom. Because I didn't live with my mom. But I can remember, you know, point by point, a lot of times that she and I were alone together as we were growing up. And in the writing of the story, I came to this place where it shifted completely from the little boy to her. And I wasn't expecting that. And I must say, I've never pondered what my mom went through because I didn't live with her. I didn't have the give and take that my siblings did with her. It's a moment where Kenny hasn't been in the town for a long time, and he asks if he can go by their old house. And it's a house that he lived in for all of his life until his parents split up, and then he went away and lived in another place. So for him, he's coming back and seeing, you know, some version of, he's literally seeing his youth, and he's not even 11 years old yet. But for the mom who is sitting there, she's looking at, and Kenny has nothing but wonderful memories of what this house was and what it meant to him. But his mom is looking at the place where her life shifted, where a huge thing came to an end, and it was bitter and horrible, and it was not a good time. And when she left under the worst conditions imaginable. So in that shift, I ended up stumbling upon something that had, I guess, had been rattling around inside me for an awful long time. And it was, not to overuse the word, an empathy for what our parents had gone through. You know, I think you go on for a long time, and everybody goes through this period in which their parents are just the root of every dumb, knot-headed thing you've ever done. You know, I'm not good because my dad wasn't nice to me when we used tools, so that's why I can't use tools, because my dad yelled at me when I tried to use tools, which is true, by the way, but I, but you get to a place where you start having kids of your own, you go through stuff, you realize your parents were just trying to get through, you know, the bitter compromises of the day, and they were just dealing with stuff, and honestly, they were not out to screw you up. they were out to make ends meet and to bring peace to the world somehow, and that ended up being, that was probably the story that gave me the most difficulty when you're in your room by yourself trying to put the sentences together.
I mean, it reminds me of this thing I've been thinking about you and your work, and you have this reputation for, you know, being America's nicest guy and decent, you know, all of these things. That I get it, but I also think that
You have no idea the pressures I'm under. Let me just say that.
I'm about to deflate these things right here. So, but I'm sure that there's something true to it, but I think that reading these stories helped me sort of realize where I think your interest is much more in understanding everybody's motivations.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And if you understand everybody's motivations, it's...
This is the thing that drives me nuts about an awful lot of the work. That is not my day job. This is a thing that came to me later, which we call at the office nonfiction entertainment. We've done a lot of it. You know, a lot of it has been, you know, John Adams or World War II stuff. We've done quite a few things that Playtone, which is the company, Playtone dubs the series for CNN, the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, the 90s. And we go at it with this philosophy of we are not going to alter anybody's motivations. We are not going to turn somebody into a bad guy or force it as into a bad force simply because they were wrong. Being wrong and evil are two different things. And God knows there's evil in this world without a doubt. But if you're going back over the long struggle of anything that, like, well, just take, for example, John Adams. We didn't turn other people into evil characters. We just turned them into people who were just wrong at the time. They didn't see it through. And even John Adams was wrong again and again and again. But that concept of trying to editorialize a brand of history for the sake of a structure, I think is a bit of a sin. I think if you're going to do that, call it something other than the what it really was. Don't call it John Adams. Call it Doug Adams, you know. Call it something else, because if you have to be careful if you're going to say based on a true story or take a historical aspect of it. If you're going to be just setting it into in a real setting, you know, that reflects the world as it actually is, don't make stuff up. Find out what it's really like, and then try to make that dynamic. There is an example of it from Band of Brothers, in which there was a character who it was just assumed that he killed German soldiers, German prisoners, and they wrote it. The guys wrote the episode and they showed it. And I said, you can't do that. We can't show it as the definitive moment that happened in this guy's life. And he says, well, everybody says he did it. Well, everybody says he did it in different versions. And so the solution was to do it in a Rashomon kind of version of it. We saw, I heard a guy and you show that, and somebody else said he did this, and somebody else said it. In that case, you get to examine the theme, you get to be authentic, but you're not purposefully turning a bad guy into a bad guy if he did or did not do what he was. And I think that's important.
Well, you also explained this one question I had as I was reading this book, which is that they're not exactly interlinking stories, but characters reappear. And so my favorite story is the first story, which is this poor hapless guy is in this relationship with this terrifying woman. And I love this story. I love this woman. And as the story goes on, you sort of, you know, she comes back and we get a sense of what's sort of motivating this terrifying woman. And she becomes very beloved to me, at least. I want to ask you one last question, and then we're going to go into this. And you mentioned, when I asked you what the germ of a story was, you mentioned sometimes the endings occur to you. Mm-hmm. And as I was reading your book again last night, I was trying to think of a grand unified theory of Tom Hanks fiction. It was not working exactly, but if I were to, I would say that what joins the stories together, other than the typewriters or the characters who appear, is the particular quality of the endings. You know, short stories tend to have particular kinds of structures. There's a climax, there's a sort of denouement. But your stories sometimes end on these moments where something has been grasped and then the story ends. And it reminds me almost of letting a balloon go. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to know, when do you as a writer know a story is done? When does it feel finished to you?
This is a fascinating question, because in fact, I guess there is something that I get up to a point. Not if anybody who's written, you just write till the ending is where it needs to be. And I think in all of the stories, they end that day. And the next day will begin anew. And they will, all the characters will be imprinted to some degree. And you realize that, oh, well, this is what their daily lives are like. In the story you're talking about, the first one is about the four friends. It's called Three Exhausting Weeks, about a guy who gets a girlfriend for a while. And, I mean, she just wears him out for 3 weeks. I mean... And that came because in the first story that I wrote about them, he mentions that, Anna treated me like I was still her boyfriend. And he, in parentheses, three exhausting weeks. And then that ended up being it. But I want to get the characters to a place where the next day will be begun both imprinted by the story that they just read and also free of it. There's about these are the meditations of my heart, which is about, it's almost verbatim how I got my first really good typewriter, but I changed the gender, and it's a woman, and it ends with her just using the typewriter the first time, and she's the sound of typing went on and on. So her life has been altered, and it's made better, it's been imprinted, but it's going to go on in a different fashion after that. So that's when I can get to that place, and I was satisfied with that, then I knew the story was over.
Thank you.
Let's
move on to some of these. Do you want to start with on a big note?
Bring it on.
This is the question.
Get it on.
Winfrey Hanks 2020.
Oh, there you go.
Hanks Winfrey 2020.
Well, here's what I would do. All right. Well, we'll take Oregon. I would say Winfrey Hanks, because then my job as her running mate would be to stand just off to the right behind her and stare adoringly at the back of her head. That seems to be what vice presidential candidates always end up doing. And that job I can handle.
So this is a question about your harmless vice. What is your very favorite typewriter and why? And just to give you some context, you have about 160 typewriters?
I've got about 250 typewriters.
Oh my God.
And
okay.
Some of them are, I know. Come on. Come on. I plan to be buried with them. We're
trying to give them away. Nobody wanted them?
I am beginning to give them away, but I'm not a sucker. You know, somebody says, hey, I hear you're giving away typewriters. I'd like me one. I don't give them to people. I have some that are objects of art that are just kind of like rickety, and none of them are valuable. I mean, if they're worth $50 and I signed them, they end up being worth about $54. I do that. It's a ridiculous, I don't know how it started, but I adore the mechanics, the engineering, and the permanence of what typewriters can create. But the idea of the perfect typewriter, it evolves because it's oftentimes a circumstance. I have a number of big, huge machines that sit in one place. I have some Olivettis that are feather light, and they're teeny. I can take them anywhere. And I have some kind of like a Ray Milland trying to pawn his typewriter on Yom Kippur in the Lost Weekend, you know, just give me $50 for this so I can buy me some booze. I got a couple of those as well. I would have to say if I had a truly favorite typewriter, it's a typewriter that is now, I'm gonna say it's 98 years old, and it's made by Royal. It's huge. It has the sturdiness of like the chassis from a 56 DeSoto or something. It's impervious. And here's the amazing thing about it. It works. Yeah, that's right, my son. Even the babies are delighted by old Royal typewriters. He's essentially saying, I'd like me one. Get your info backstage, and I'll send you a typewriter for that that youngster. It'll last for another 100 years. The thing about this typewriter, that's right. It works exactly as it did out of the crate or out of the factory in 1922. How many devices do we have in our lives that do not disappoint? You can't buy a refrigerator from 1922 or a car. You know, fountain pens from 1922 don't work as well as this typewriter does now. It's astounding. It's so great and lasted so long that it became impossible for the typewriter company to make any money because they did not have built-in obsolescence. You didn't like ride into the Royal Typewriter Company and try to download Typewriter 2.0. And the truth is, it is unhackable. Exactly as it was in 1922.
This is an interesting one, I think, especially given, I know your interest in history. So the question is, have you ever considered writing a nonfiction book, and what would you write about?
I would not, and here's the reason why. Because I think if you're going to write a book about it, there is not the same leeway that I have in examining things in the stories that I do. The nonfiction entertainment that we pursue, we do as labors of love, and everybody who works on them end up getting sort of like master's degrees in the subject matter. We always have something in the hopper that is based on nonfiction, and I'm not a scholar. You know, I wouldn't know, you know, Ibid, I wouldn't know what to, you know, the footnotes alone are going to, like, drive me. Unless I can crack jokes in the footnotes, I'm not going to go there. So I'm satisfied with, I think, of a broader picture that I think is more accessible. Every time we do something that is nonfiction, I say, hey, remember, for good or for bad, this is going to be on a library shelf. You know, it's going to be assigned viewing for high schoolers and stuff like that. So we need to get that right.
First book you loved.
The first book I loved, I started reading for real when I was in fifth grade. The first book I read for real was The Hobbit, Right? Okay. Fine and dandy. Here's the bad news. Right after that, I took up the first of the Ring trilogy. I got about 40 pages in. I said, I get this. I get it. Okay. Frodo, Bilbo, got it. I'm good. But I started writing this kind of, I read the works of Leon Uris, you know, Mila 18 and Armageddon. I will tell you the first book that blew the back off of my head, that affected me like great literature and art does. I read in high school, I'm going to say when I was 15 maybe, I read In Cold Blood by Truman Capote. And that established a benchmark that what was horrifying, 10 times more horrifying about it was that it really happened. And that I lost sleep over reading that book. That's how I would say that was the first book that affected me the way books can.
Do you have advice for aspiring writers?
First of all, no. Why would you come to me? I mean, you know. This is the best advice I've ever heard about writing. And I get it all the time because somebody has written a screenplay that they have invested in a lot. They say, I poured my heart and soul into this. This is so important to me. I have never worked harder on a screenplay than I have on this. And I say, great, go write another one. And I think that's the only advice you could really give to any writer. Great, got it. You did it, fantastic. Go write another one. Go write something else. Keep writing. Never stop writing. Write. There you go.
So
good luck.
We have time for one last question, and I'm getting to it, but I would like to say that a shocking amount of these are requests for hugs.
Ah.
Okay.
Let's just go like this. Ready? Raise it. Put your arms out wide. Man, that feels good, doesn't it? I will grant one hug, but only one hug right at the end. Bring that baby down here so I can, not till we're done. If the baby is still here, just come down to the edge and I gotta see this kid.
Okay, so one last question, and perhaps like the best note to sort of end on is, will you write another book?
Wow, okay, yes. When? Thank you, that's very kind of you. Well, that's the dilemma, isn't it? I have met some really, you know, like ridiculously famous and accomplished musicians who have made some of the greatest records of all time. And this thing happens when they release a record that they have essentially been compiling for all of their life. And then 6 months later, they have to do another one. But that record is going to be based on things they've been compiling for the last 6 months. So it ends up being difficult. I have a great relationship with the folks at Penguin. My editor, Peter Gathers, who is just one of the greatest guy in the world, he has said, "You, what are you going to write next?" And I said, look, I have some things rattling around, and I'm not absolutely sure, other than I will write something again. I can't imagine living without it now.
The great Tom Hanks.
Thank you. Bring that kid down here.
That was Tom Hanks in conversation with Parul Sehgal at the Portland Book Festival in November 2018. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project, a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from the Archive Project, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Support for the Archive Project comes from Cole Haan, the fashion brand that aims to inspire and empower people to live an extraordinary life. All this and more at colehaan.com. Our show is produced by Crystal Liguori for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the literary arts staff, board, and community. This show would not be possible without them. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.